Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes with DailyStraits.com. Today, I have a very special guest with me to introduce to all of you, my former boss, Dato' Sri Kalimullah Hassan, who also happens to be the chairman of ECM Libra, a public listed company based in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Dato' Sri Kalimullah began his career as a journalist in 1979 in Penang before going on to work with big news agencies such as Singapore Straits Times and Reuters. He was a correspondent and journalist till 1995, after which he decided to venture into the business world. It was in 2002 that he and his two partners started a boutique investment advisory firm, which later evolved 4 years later into ECM Libra Investment Bank. He remains as a non-executive chairman of the group, which is now an investment holding company owning a chain of hotels, together with their long-term partners, Airline Air Asia owners Tony Fernandez and Kamarudin Maranum. Besides leading his own company, some of Dato' Sri's notable gigs in the past include being appointed chairman of the Malaysian National News Agency, Bernama, in September 22, 2002, and in January 24 as the editor-in-chief, EEIC, of Malaysia's oldest newspaper, the New Straits Times Press Berhad. After leaving the EEIC post in 2005, Dato' Sri Kalimullah remained as the deputy chairman of the newspaper till December 31st, 2008. Since then, he has authored a book titled The Malaysia That Be, which was published in 2015. So without further ado, let's bring Dato' Sri Kalimullah to the show and ask him how he transitioned himself from a journalist to a high-flying corporate person he is today. So hi, Dato' Sri. Thank you so much for bearing with me with that long introduction. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Awesome. Let's dive right into the question. So Dato' Sri, can you just tell me what got you started into journalism in 1979? Why did you pick that as your first, your career?
Since I was a kid, I've always been interested in journalism. I do not know about your time, but our time, we had to fill in these cards where we put down your three career choices. And my three career choices were lawyer, journalist, and a doctor. What inspired me to want to become a journalist was, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, because I read their book, All the President's Men. I was quite an avid reader of books in those days. Not anymore. You know how they uncovered the Watergate scandal and all that. So every young kid of that time, who read that book wanted to be a scandal exposing journalist. So after my secondary school education, I applied for jobs in several news organizations. Not many in those days. I was rejected by the Straits Times and I was rejected by the Star. And finally, I got a job in the National Echo, a Penang-based newspaper. And that's how I started my career in journalism. And from them, I moved on to 6 months later to the Star and subsequently to the Reuters and Straits Times, Time magazine for 2 years. And then to Singapore Press Holdings, after which I left journalism and went into business.
Awesome. So what was your beats? What did you cover when you were a journalist?
Initially, all journalists in our time had to do court reporting first, because that's where you're supposed to learn how to report accurately, because if you make a mistake in court reporting, then you get into huge trouble. So from court, and I went on to cover the defense industry, and eventually I started specializing in political reporting, and that's where I made my name as a journalist and covering politics in Malaysia.
Awesome. So it took you close to probably 20 years before you decided to dabble into business, right?
Correct. Okay. About close to 18 years, yeah.
Okay, so all right. So switch careers? You know, were you fed up of journalism, or you just wanted a new challenge?
Well, as time grew, by 1995, I had 4 kids, and as you know very well, journalism is not a well-paying job. While I enjoyed, I had job satisfaction, but still, I wanted to give my kids a much better life than I had. And I realized that the only way was to go into a better paying career. And fortunately, at that time, I was offered, I was headhunted by one of the big headhunting firms, Russell Reynolds, to have a corporate job in KL. And I joined PCB, which was owned by Tan Sri Dr. Chen Lip Kiong, where he put me in charge of a college and a newspaper in Cambodia. And that's how I started my business career in 1995.
So it was moonlighting while you were in a job, or was it completely you left the career and then you started a business?
Oh, I left. I resigned from my last job, which was in the Singapore Straits Times, Singapore Press Holdings, in 95, and joined Tan Sri Chen Lip Kiong.
Okay, so tell me, Dato, when you were trying to do the, sorry, Dato Sri, when you were doing the transition, did you have any buffer money or like, you know, you I also ask this to all entrepreneurs, you know, when they want to go into the business world, because it's a, you know, you do, it will take some time before you make money. But how did you approach this new career venture? Did you go in with a chunk of money that you've saved up just in case if it doesn't work out? Or do you speak to your old bosses and say, look, I want to try this out. If it doesn't work out, I'll go back to you.
Oh, no, no. It was a clean break. And like I said, when I joined Tan Sri Chen, I was an employee. I was not an entrepreneur. But it gave me the opportunity to learn things from running the college and running the newspaper in Cambodia. I left after 2 years Tan Sri Chen to start my own business with few partners. Unfortunately, that business did not do too well, and I lost quite a lot of, almost all my savings. When the financial crisis came in 98, I had lost all my money. So I had to start all over again.
What business was that? Is it banking or something?
No, it was a development. So, you know, as you we were planning to set up oil tank farms. It was a business I was not familiar with, but I was a small investor, only 10%. Still, I put my money in and lost everything. But during that time, I was on the board of a brokerage firm, which belonged to a friend of mine, and he put me on the board of his asset management company, and that gave me the opportunity to learn a lot of things about asset management and securities. And I was on the board of this company for about 6 years, maybe until we started our own company, ECM Libra.
Okay, so tell us about the so ECM took some time from 1995. It took like maybe 7 to 8 years before it started, before you had the idea to start it.
7 years, yeah.
Okay. So what about, how did that come about? You were sitting down with some friends and they say, okay, let's pull our ideas together, resources together and start this.
Well, it was the other way around. My two partners, whom I've known for quite a long time, one day, it was in Bangsa, in Davies. We were having an early breakfast, and then they said to me, I said, why don't we team up? He said, you have got relationships, you know a lot of people, and the two of us know a lot of people in the financial services. We've been involved in financial services for a long time. I think the three of us will make a very good team. I hesitated, and I said, I want time to think about it. But eventually, I decided that, you know, it's an industry I'm not unfamiliar with. I've been there on the board of TA Securities, TA Enterprise, TA Asset Management, TA Unit Trust for about 6-7 years. I said, I've learned some things. I said, let's give it a shot. So that's how we started ECM Libra.
So then how did you go about it? Because like those days, right, how do you start a bank, like investment? What is the investment like? Who do you hire? What do you do first? Do you get a bank license?
Well, it was... You know, when we started in 2002, the Labuan Offshore Financial Services Authority, LOFSA, was actively encouraging people with a financial services background to set up investment advisory companies and banks in Labuan. It required a capitalization of 10 million ringgit. I put in my savings plus I borrowed some money to put in my share of to capitalize the bank. And we started off as an offshore investment bank in Labuan from 2002. And then several years later, when Bank Negara invited companies with track record to apply for an onshore investment banking license, we applied. We went through several rounds of rigid vetting, and we were one of, if I'm not mistaken, one of six groups which were given an onshore banking license to operate out of Kuala Lumpur.
Okay, so 2000, how does this offshore Labuan works? What do you give money to? How do you make business from that?
Well, basically, you book the deals offshore in Labuan, but you can operate out of KL. And there was strict vetting, of course, by LOFSA and Bank Negara. It works the same way as an investment bank in KL, except that your bank is based out of Labuan instead of in Kuala Lumpur.
So, got it. So, it's a virtual office there, right? But you work out of KL, right? No.
Yeah, I lost you.
Yes, Dato Sri. It's a virtual office in Labuan or what?
No, we had actually a physical office with one staff in Labuan. We used to go there every quarter to have a board meeting, a physical meeting. But it was only for a few years. And finally, when we got our onshore banking license, we wound up the Labuan investment bank. Since then, they have become very strict because I think there were people who used offshore bank other purposes, like, you know, laundering money and stuff like that. I think there were a couple of big scandals there. And eventually now, I think you don't hear of offshore banks in Labuan very much.
Okay. So you were, at the time, you were pretty lucky that you got that. So what was the hurdles in starting the investment bank? Was it talent or the capital? It seemed quite easy for you to pull through. Did you have the issues with that?
No, not really a problem because, when we started our investment advisory services and all that, we did quite well, because I think my two partners as well are quite well known in the banking industry, in the financial services industry. So we pooled our resources and we got people we knew in the corporate sector and we did deals for them, restructuring and stuff like that. The early days were not easy because we literally had to go and beg people to give us a chance.
Even hiring people to work with you?
No, to beg people to give us deals. So we made our money from the deals that we did in the early years. And subsequently, when we got our onshore banking license, we decided that the only way we could compete with the bigger banks was to get the best people. So we hired good people, gave them share options, gave them good salaries. And being a new company, I think there was a lot of energy there. So we did quite well, you know. In fact, a lot of the people that who started with us have gone on to really, really big jobs in Khazanah, in CIMB, in MIDF, in a lot of overseas financial institutions. I mean, one of our staff is now the managing director of Deutsche Bank in Hong Kong. So they were good people. They did well for us and they went on to do very well with their own lives.
So tell me, who was your first client where you've already come off to KL and you've done everything? Who was the one who gave you your first break?
Well, our first client was Dato Ishak Ismail of KFC and Tantri Tajirin Ramli of Celcom. Because Tajirin Ramli and my senior partner Ken On, they had known each other, and Ken On had been advising him for probably about a decade when he was the when he ran Malaysian Airlines. And so he actually gave Ken On a chance rather than me or David Chua, the other partner. So we did some work for Tan Sri Tajuddin Ramli and Ishak Ismail. They were our first clients. And well, the deal with Ishak did not finally go through, but he paid us our fees. But the Tajuddin Ramli deal went through, and that's how we started our first deals. Subsequently, okay. We went on to do other things, yeah.
Awesome. And then later on, you went and listed your company, right?
It was, yeah, 3 years later, we listed it in 2004.
So when you started the company, when the time they approached you in Davies and the time you went back and thought about it, and then you said yes to them eventually, was there like a business plan? How did that work, like that part of it? Like, or you just went in and then figured everything out?
I mean, it would have been stupid if we did that, you know. of course, we had a plan. If I was going to put in my life savings into it, after having been wiped out in 1998, I had to be sure that it was a workable plan. So we actually discussed what we would do and stuff like that. We had a business plan. But of course, along the way, you know, when opportunities come, you try to, you amend, you change, and you go for the other opportunities. Some were successful, some were not. So, but yeah, we had a plan. I think we did quite well in the initial years when we started, the first probably 7-8 years. I mean, one of our biggest breaks was AirAsia with Tony Fernandez. We approached him to ask him whether we could... he was talking about listing AirAsia. We asked him whether we could get the opportunity. Then he looked at us and he laughed. And he said, you know, you guys are new kids on the block. He said, what can you do? So we sat down with him. We told him, you know, when you started your airline, you started it with ₱1. And whoever thought that you would be a success coming from the music industry? Actually, it was Brendan who introduced me to Tony Fernandez, because Brendan is related to Tony. And Tony said, okay. He said, the good thing about Tony was, he said, okay, I'll give you a chance. He said, let's see what you can do. So we worked together with Credit Suisse. And of course, as it turned out, we did a successful roadshow for Tony all over the US and UK and Europe. Together with Credit Suisse, and we listed AirAsia for him. And that basically brought our, made our name, like, you know, because we it was oversubscribed by many times, AirAsia, and all those who bought, subscribed to it at that time, they all made money. So that was our really one major break for us. So, yeah, that's how we those are some of the deals I remember very fondly.
What about the listing of ECM Libra? Was that part of your plan when you first got together, or just something?
The what?
That you
Sorry?
Had? You're listing the company. Was it part of the plan or something that just happened?
Well, eventually, of course, we wanted to list the company, but you know, you have to have a track record to list it. So fortunately, the first few years we did quite well, and we used that to do. There are a lot of advantages of listing because then you can raise capital and fund your business and expand. So we did a reverse takeover of a ailing company which belonged to Tan Sri Azman Hashim, South Peninsula Industries. It was losing money, so we injected ECM Libra into it and did a reverse takeover and listed it. And that's how Tan Sri Azman was one of the substantial shareholders in ECM Libra when we listed it. So that's how it was in the plan, but we didn't expect it to come in 3 years down the road after we started. Like I said, you know, when the opportunities come, you take advantage of it. You try to, I mean, there were some we succeeded, like the listing. Some we didn't succeed.
Okay. So tell me, Dato'Sri, what is this ECM Libra about? Like, why did you decide on this name, Libra, especially?
Well, Libra was my partner's original company, which is started in Hong Kong in 1993. ECM stands for Equity Capital Markets. So we decided to call it ECM Libra because we merged with Canon's company Libra, which already had a track record in financial services. So that's how we call it ECM Libra.
Awesome. All right. I just wanted to ask you, is there a set recipe in choosing business partners? Because a lot of people, they go and get into partnerships and sometimes it turns really sour after a few years. But you also stand the test of time. So what are some of the criteria you look into before you start partnering with a person to start a business?
Yeah, over the years, I've gone into other businesses with other partners and all that. But I find that ultimately, it's someone you know well, someone you have learned to trust as a friend, someone who has got a reputation of being honest. I think that's the best, because you know a lot of people come to you with business proposals and plans and all that, and normally you don't know a lot of these people. Some people get greedy because they think, oh, I'm going to make a lot of money, and that's where they start losing their money. So in my case, I knew both my partners for quite some time, and they had very good reputations in the industry. They didn't have a reputation as crooks or, you know, someone who goes into a gray area and all that. So that part of it, I was very comfortable. The question was, do I dump my money into a business and am I sure that I'm going to get out of it again? So I said, I take the risk because firstly, I've got two good partners, honest guys, and all three of us trusted each other. And secondly, we all had knowledge of the industry. Of course, my two partners were more knowledgeable because they had been there for a much longer time and had worked for really big companies like Accenture, Merrill Lynch, before we teamed up, Hong Leong. They were both CEOs of Hong Leong. I think that's a very important criteria, choosing people that you know and whom you trust. That's very important.
So, okay, now you've evolved. The company is no longer, you told me just now, you sold the investment part of the business and the company is now on a different trajectory, right? So what was the idea? Why that? Why the shift?
Well, the industry became very competitive, and we did have the balance sheet to eventually, because, you know, things became more bigger. You needed a big balance sheet to go and do big deals and all that. And we didn't have it. So when we were offered to sell the investment bank and eventually our unit trust and asset management side of it to Kenanga, which actually had the balance sheet, which was had the biggest securities, the brokers in the industry. So we said they're paying us good money, good multiples. We sell it. And then that's when, after selling it, we decided to buy into Tune Hotels, of which we were already partners, both me and Canon, together with Tony and Kamarudin. So we bought over and we took control of Tune Hotels, which at that time had hotels. We had 5 hotels in UK, and we had hotels in Australia, in Thailand, in Manila. So we bought it over, and it was losing money. Tune Hotels was losing money. So we bought it over and we downsized it, and now we are running it ourselves, although Tony and Kamarudin are still partners. So then we also invested in Epsom College, which belonged to Tony Fernandez. We took a stake there, and we used the money that we got from selling the bank and asset management to invest in other businesses.
How is the business doing now, especially with Corona? Is it
I think for us, we are all in the wrong kind of businesses. Like education is affected by the COVID. Hotels are badly affected by the COVID. But you know, these are tests that we have to go through. So I think once the borders open up, once tourism opens up, and our school will do well, and our hotels also will go back to making money for us. The trick is to last out this period, because we do not know how long these COVID restrictions are going to carry on. Although the encouraging sign is that most countries are opening up economic activity. So we can see a little bit of an uptick in bookings in our hotels and pick up in the businesses. But we are still losing money. Let's see how it goes. I think we should, if everything goes well, then I hope by sometime end of next year we should come out of it and start doing okay again.
So you're still pulling through la, with you using your own money to survive at the moment, or
we're not in dire straits. I think we have been very prudent and thrifty over the years. We have practically no bank borrowings, almost zero. So we can survive. But if it goes on for another 2 years, 3 years, then we'll have to decide what to do, because I don't think that our resources are unlimited. We will have to decide what to do if this COVID doesn't go away.
Okay, Dato, I want to take you back. Sorry, Dato Sri, I want to take you back to the time when you were in Davy's Corner, right? When they approached you. And then you say you wanted to go back to think about it. I just was wondering, like, why didn't you decide on doing something like a simpler business? But then you know, despite everything you went through, you still went ahead with these two guys. What was that turning point? Do you still remember?
Yeah. You asked me why did I not start a restaurant? What do I know about restaurants? I mean, at least this was a business that I knew something about. And I had two partners who were quite well regarded in the industry. So if it was something that none of us knew anything about, then I definitely wouldn't have gone in. I mean, just like any other thing, you want to go into something that you're familiar with. If you have been working in a mamak restaurant, I mean, I was with the owner of Kayu last week. I was having a chat with him. He just finished his standard six and he was working in a restaurant, and he saw how, you know, if he managed quality control and he would do well. And look at him, he's got a chain of Kayu restaurants throughout the country, even in Melbourne, and he even opened up in London and all that, because he grew up in the industry, he knew about the industry. And so that's how he did it. So he's a very successful man. I really admire him for somebody who didn't finish his secondary education. His children have done very, very well. They are all doctors and working in Ireland and UK, you know. So he told me that he never dreamed that he could give his children an education in UK, and that he could own a flat in UK or flat in Melbourne. He's done very well. Yeah, so because he knew what he was doing.
So some advice that you can impart to journalists wanting to quit the profession and start their own business. Because the last time I read I used to read your articles in the NST, and you said when you started out, you only earned like what, 70 bucks, 80, less than 100 bucks a month or something like that?
235 ringgit, out of which my take home was maybe minus my EPF and stuff like that, probably about 170, 180 ringgit. That's how I started. I mean, to me, journalism was a very satisfying job. It was probably the job where I was happiest in. But eventually, the realities, like, you know, I wanted to give my family a better life, give them a very good education, which I think I managed to give them a good education, and they're all pretty solid and well-grounded. So my advice to journalists would be, look, I mean, if you're happy in your job, money is not everything. Then you get your job satisfaction. I know a lot of journalists who have retired, like Rudy Beltran was, I don't know whether you remember him. He was my neighbor until a couple of weeks ago when I moved to another place. He was my neighbor. He was a crime editor of New Straits Times. He is happy. He's 80 plus years old now. He looks back to his life as a journalist very fondly. But of course, if you're not happy in your job and you want to quit the profession, you want to start your own business, I think do something that you are familiar with. Find partners, especially those who can help you, who are familiar with the business that you want to start. I think that's the best advice I can give, because you know, opportunities come all the time. It's a question of whether you recognize the opportunity and seize it.
But we meet a lot of high flyers, you know, like, because we cover the news. Do you like see it as an unprofessional for the journalist to approach the news speaker later for opportunities, or is this like a frowned thing to do, or what do you have an opinion on this?
I'm sorry, I don't get you.
Meaning, like, we go for an assignment, we see somebody there who can actually help us in a business, and then we approach them on the side. What do you think about this kind of behaviors? Some journalists resort to that, but you know, not all.
Well, I think if you want to use your contacts to get a leg up in life, then you quit the profession. You don't sell your soul to people while still in the industry. I remember I used to have these problems when I was in the editor-in-chief of Straits Times, and there were people I think who used their contacts in business to promote their business and get paid for it on besides earning a salary from the organization. So that's not right, because you're using compromising the integrity of the organization. But if you have contacts who want to help you, you quit the profession and go with them. You know, why not? If they trust you as a source, they think that you have been loyal to them. You know, they want to help you. So I don't see any downside to that. But quit your job. Quit your day job.
All right, and that is all the time that we have for today. We have just been speaking to Dato Sri Kalimullah Hassan, the chairman of ECM Libra Group Berhad. Thank you very much, Dato Sri, for joining me today in this chat.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And the pleasure is all ours, Dato Sri. Be sure to join me next week, where I aim to interview another awesome entrepreneur from around the world. Thank you.